annual Lucy Davidovich Memorial Lecture, which will be given by Professor Ruth Weiss of Harvard University. She will speak on the subject, I can remember it exactly, it was counting 60 and still 60 and still counting. I think it was. Excuse me? What do you think? Not talking about getting old. Not talking about me.
She used to be professor of Yiddish at Montreal, I think.
She was professor of Yiddish at McGill, McGill University of Montreal. She is professor of, what is it called? Comparative literature and Yiddish literature, or Jewish literature, at Harvard. And she teaches both Hebrew and Yiddish literature. She's probably the greatest living authority in the field. One of our great intellectuals in the Jewish community, and a longtime friend of Ozarua. She actually gave this lecture, not this lecture, but she gave a Lucy Davidovich lecture many years ago. It's the second year that we had these lectures. We've only had two people who are repeats. Professor Yosef Yerushalmi gave two of them, and Ruth Weiss, who has given two of them. In both cases, these are people who were close to Lucy Davidovich, and many years have gone by, and I suspect that none of you remembers that lecture.
I don't remember that.
You were there.
Yeah. Do you remember what she spoke about?
She spoke about, I think, parents. Parents. Your Lamed Tes.
Parents.
The Yiddish author.
The level of discourse.
The Yiddish author, parents.
Okay.
She speaks the Queen's English as a Canadian would. Her brother, she comes from just a wonderful family. Her brother is professor of Yiddish literature at the Jewish Theological Seminary. Professor David Rosky is the seminary's professor of Yiddish literature, and Montreal is an interesting place to grow up.
She must be fluent in French.
She must be.
I'm talking about the language.
What else might she have been in French?
Don't ask him. My brother lived a little bit below Montreal, upstate New York, and he turned on TV.
Is
that French TV?
Sure. Plenty of that. So that'll be next week, and we look forward to that at the time, and I hope you'll all be there. It will be very worthwhile, I'm sure. She's just published a book on Jewish power, and she's been traveling the country, and I'm sure that she will really be incorporating those ideas and those issues into this talk. And we've had the benefit the last 2 years, last year, and I think it's going to be the case this year too, that hopefully this will be she'll publish this lecture after she gets it to Rosa Rua. We plant these seeds, and they seem to be taking. 8 o'clock. It'll be 8 o'clock in the sanctuary. Tonight I'm going to cut the time a little bit because I'm a little under the weather. I didn't come out today, but I want to come out tonight, and I feel better, actually, as a result of staying in. So the energy's not too bad. Don't come too close, but the energy's pretty good. But I don't want to push it too far. Because we have a big weekend coming up in Ozarua. It's next week, for the entire week of events is really jam-packed.
Yeah, the big football game, that's it.
You see, what would the Giants do without me if I'm not there?
Right.
So I
you
know.
You want to let them know.
I don't want to disappoint them, so Take good care, friends.
What? I'm a big time football fan. I don't believe that.
So I gather. Maybe that's what he meant by French. It could have been football, you think?
I love football.
Okay. All right. Ladies and gentlemen, we're on 6A1. If you remember, we have been discussing the subject of the formula which must be said together with the presentation of the keses, of that which is either money or something of monetary value, in order to have that act of giving something function as a kinyan, function as an act that changes the status of the people who are involved. And we have seen that there are a variety of acceptable formulae, even though the one that we are used to is Hareat Nekudeshet Li. That is the basic formula. We see that there are certain other possibilities also, which largely mean the same thing. And we see that it has to be formulated in such a way that it reflects the way in which the Torah itself speaks about the act of marriage, or at least the act of kinyan, which is ki yikach ish isha, when a man acquires a wife. So since this is an act of kinyan, the act of kinyan is structured the way the Torah in fact states the act of kinyan. Okay? Kinyan being acquisition. All right, so now we're going to look at some other phrases and do some analysis of them. Tanu Rabbanan. Tanu Rabbanan is the introduction always to a baraita. And a baraita, remember, is a piece of rabbinic literature which dates from the time of the Mishnah, but was excluded from the Mishnah. It was not included by Rabbi Judah the Prince in the Mishnah in the year 200. Hare at ishti, hare at arusati, hare at knuyali mikudeshet. Right, we have now three other formulations, some of which we've already seen. Hare at ishti, behold you are my wife. Hare at arusati, behold you are my arusa. Translated here as betrothed, but it's not really appropriate. Hare at knuyali, acquired to me. Okay. That coming from ki yikach ish isha, that's an act of kinyan, so kinyan is kanui, or knuya in this case, so it's synonym, mikudeshet. All of those are okay to say, and they will produce a proper act of kinyan. Hare at sheli, hare at birshuti, hare at sukukali, mikudeshet. Three other possibilities. Hareat Sheli, you are mine. You are in my jurisdiction, as it were. Birshuti, Birshut Sheli, my jurisdiction. Hareat Zikukali, you are bound to me. Mikudeshet. These are actually less obvious. The second triplet, I think, is less obvious than the first triplet. But the Baraita says also Mikudeshet. This is a valid act of kinyan. So again, it must be, even though these are more vague. Now, I would have wanted them to say, Hareat Ishti. That's pretty clear. You are my wife. Or Hareat Arusati. You are my betrothed. That's pretty clear. It's less clear to say, Hareat Birshuti. You're in my jurisdiction. Hareat Zupukali. You're attached to me. Hareat Sheli. That I don't like at all. Because Hare Achali is one of these terms of endearment. You're mine. You're mine. You know, people say that.
Valentine.
You're mine. Yeah, that's right. Correct. Valentine's Day, exactly.
Is this in front of witnesses?
No, there's no indication that this is in front of witnesses.
How do you substantiate what he or she said?
Well, so far, there's no indication that this has to be in front of witnesses. So far. So, at least that's as far as this goes, my assumption is that it isn't. Okay? Maybe it is, but I think probably it isn't. You'll see that my assumption that it isn't is partly based on having read more of this you'll see that the context of this discussion, I think, presupposes that there are no witnesses here. Now, the Gemara asks the obvious question here. We read a Braita where there is a triplet, and then it says, Mekudeshet. It's another triplet, and frankly, when I read the second triplet, I don't know how you felt when you read the second, but when I read the second triplet, I figured it was going to say, Eina Mekudeshet. That's what I thought it was going to say, that this is not a valid Kiddushin. Then doesn't say that. So the Gemara says, V'litna hu kol hukachada. Why, if all of these are valid, why aren't they taught all 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6? And then it says, Mekudeshet. Right? That's the way it should have been done. No. The answer is an interesting answer. Tana talat talat shan inhu v'garsinu. The Tana taught this Baraita as he heard them in groups of three, and so he recited them in groups of three. That's kind of, you know, it's not an issue that's very germane to any of the substance that we're dealing with. I think it is an interesting response in terms of the structure and the nature of the oral law. The oral law very frequently will operate in terms of threes or fours. Rarely, not never, but rarely do you get larger numbers. I mean, you do, for example, in Masechet Avot, there are 10 things created before the beginning of the world, 9 things and 6, 7 things like that. You do have some of that. But it's very, very common that the Mishnah speaks in terms of threes and fours. The one that you know best in terms of fours. What? That's true. But which is the four that you know? Right? So you start with four questions, and then you go to four children. Okay? So threes and fours are really your numbers, just in terms of the oral literature, and it's pretty simple. Why? Because it's a memorized system, and the memory works very well in threes and fours. It's very common to have threes and fours. Hickory, dickory, dock. The mouse ran up the clock. Right? What is it? Those are two threes. Right? Those are triplets. Hickory, dickory, dust, the mouse, and a clock. Okay? That's how these systems work. So, similarly, that is the response here of the Gemara to say, this is the way it was taught in the oral system, and therefore the Tana teaches it the way he learned it. And it's all part of the oral conveyance of information. Okay? There's no particular substance to it. It's really a matter of form.
But it is more substantive because in all of the ancient literature, if your people react best to any kind of program, like a three themes, then that's it.
Oh, we all know this as teachers.
Right.
You get beyond three themes, you're finished.
But, and for even complex programs, mm-hmm. If you want to run in a company or any government agency, you can do four or three. Two doesn't get you enough. Five
right.
Overwhelms people.
Exactly.
Something about as a human being reacts truly the best for three or four.
Exactly. I think we would all agree.
Yeah, my students would say, well, what's the foundation for that?
Yeah, what's the foundation?
All of us as people.
That's correct. The foundation is Tana Tlat Tlat Shamin Huvagarsinu. Right? Three is the way you hear it, three is the way you teach it. Right? That's the way it is. Okay. Now, three things the world stands.
Okay,
here's
the best one. Telephone numbers. 3, 3, and 4.
Five people can remember.
Telephone numbers.
That's good, you're right.
You break it down into 3, 3, 4.
That's correct. Good observation. Correct. I remember that there are places where they don't do that. And for a while, in my experience, they weren't doing it clearly in Israel. I got so mixed up that every time I got a telephone number, I broke it into that. And then finally, the Israelis didn't have it because they were missing one number. They were missing a number. And then they added a number a while ago, about 3 years ago. They added a number, so now it goes just like the threes and fours. It's now a 3-4 combination. Yeah, if somebody gives me a number like that, I get totally mixed up. I cannot deal with it, because I can only deal with it in threes and fours. Four and five. I maybe could do that. I couldn't do anything more than that. More than four can't possibly take. Can't, my head can't do it. Trust me. Okay. Ibayalohu. Now, Ibayalohu is a question that is asked among the Amoraim. The Amoraim will most likely be commenting now on the Baraita. That's some material that we have already learned before. Or conceivably something that's connected to it. But here we had learned before, Miyuchedet li mahu. Miyuchedet li mahu. Right, these are now a variety of other possibilities. If a man says to the woman, Miyuchedet li, you are singled out for me. Miyuchedet li, you are designated for me. Well, those you can understand, you know, they're just, it makes sense. Those are phrases that may not come from biblical literature per se. They may not be commonly used, but they sort of mean what we're trying to say here. Next is Ezrati Mahu. Ezrati, that's the
word.
Correct, because the Torah says that God creates woman to be Ezer Kenegdo. We say a helpmeet for him, whatever that means. Ezer Kenegdo. So, what if you say Ezrati? Right? Hare at Ezrati. Behold, you are my Ezra. Quote, you know, very sophisticated, according to Torah. Next one, at Negdati. Ezra Kenegdo. Alright, so. Negdati, my opponent, as it were, but you're quoting again from the verse which says, Ezra Kenegdo, a helpmeet opposite him, or something like that. Ezrati, so you say, Negdati, my Negda. Atsurati, my gathered one. I don't know that it's from any biblical source. I'm not aware of any biblical source. All I can see is that it's from Atseret.
No,
that's with the here has an iron.
That's the problem.
The iron's a big in the west.
I think it's a
variation. Sela T, that's an easy one. That's good. It's from Sela, which is rib. You are my rib. That's a sweet thing to say. That's a nice thing to say. You're my rib. All right? Segurati. And now, because God closed up the place where he took out the rib. So, Sagur, the closed up. My closed up one. Okay? You're my closed one. Tachti. What does it say? Tachtai. All right? The red tachti in my place. This is something that's just different. Tefusati. Tefusati is my seized one. Maybe that's too strong. Tefus is my one I've taken away. I think of it as, you know, a carrier off on a white horse. There she is, Tefusati. You're the one I've carried away. I've grabbed you away. Okay, that's my romantic translation. Lukuchati. Lukuchati from Lakach. Lakach. Alright? Ki yikach ish isha. When a man shall take a wife. So Lakachat. Lakuach means the one who is taken. So this, the Gemara answers. Pshot mi hachada. One of these is easy to answer. I don't see which one that is. Titania says that a Baraita. And the Baraita says, Ha'omer lekuchati, harei zo mekudeshet. Right? The Baraita says, the one who says, Lukukhati, the taken one, you are my taken one, that is Mekudeshet. Mishum Shinamar, because it says in the Torah, Ki Yikach Ish Isha, when a man takes a woman. So, interestingly enough, there is no response to the others. So, the others are kind of left hanging. And we'll get to that. I'll read to you the Shulchan Aruch in a little while. But for the moment, they're left hanging, and you kind of wonder where they're going. The only one that is affirmed here is the one that is Lukuchati. Lukuchati is affirmed, and you can see that. The problem with the others is in each of these cases, you don't know whether this is for marriage or it's an expression of affection. I mean, all of these things are nice, but marriage is different from nice. You could feel warmth, you could feel emotion, you could feel affection, and you could express that. But marriage is, again, not exactly the same thing.
Maybe because Adam did not take it. He was created and given to have an act of marriage.
Well, it's taken, though, by the rabbis to be an act of marriage. Yeah, it's taken by to be an act of marriage.
But this would have to be done in conjunction with Kesef or Star.
Correct. It would have to be in conjunction with one of these other things.
Sitting on a far bench and turn stuff.
Correct. Correct. So, it's a good example, right? Sitting on a park bench, he turns to her, and he says one of these things. So the question is he being sweet? Is he sweet-talking her? No, or even in the most positive way, not in a negative way, that has a sort of pejorative sense to it, is he just being really nice, expressing his affection to her, or is there more to it than that? And of course, just by itself would mean nothing. But if he gives her something, shaveh kesef, something worth money, and together with that, then says something in addition, like this, what are we to learn from this? Is it an expression of his affections? Or is it an act of marriage? No, that's not a small thing, as you can imagine. Ever so many people make a big deal to when they finally get married, but they don't want to be married before they want to be married. And till it's over, it ain't over. So that's the problem here. And we really haven't answered the questions for these other ones in the left hand. Okay, Mara goes on. Ibayalaho. Again, another Ibayalaho. So these are the Amoraim raising questions. And you don't know. I mean, usually with Ibayalahos, it's the same as the ones that we just read, usually these are theoretical questions. Now they're sitting around. Ibayalaho means it was asked of them. And you can imagine them sitting around studying the subject and saying, oh, but what if you do this? And what if you do that? And how about this? And how about that? As the students are piping up in class. On the other hand, this is also very practical material. So that while you can imagine the students raising theoretical possibilities, it could also be that this is from life. They don't really know. Except to say that Ibayalaho is usually theoretical type questions. Okay? So here's another Ibayalaho. Charufati mahu. The man says to the woman, Charufati. Now that's a biblical allusion. I'll give you the biblical allusion here. This is the book of Leviticus, Vayikra, chapter 19, verse 20. And it goes on a little bit beyond that. Ish ki yishkav et isha. If a man should lie with a woman, English translation here says, if a man has carnal relations with a woman, interesting translation, shechvat zera, and they have sex, the hi shifcha necharefet ish, and she is a maidservant, meaning in all likelihood a Canaanite slave. Right? She's a Canaanite slave. Necharefet le'ish, she is designated for a Jewish man. Now the question will be here, if she, if these were two Jewish people, and there had been some act of designation between them, we don't know exactly what that is, but the act of designation could very well be something like Kiddushin. Okay? That there's an act of kinyan, which is to say there's a betrothal. But there really can't be a betrothal here in this case, because this is a Canaanite slave, and the reality of Canaanite slaves is that once a Canaanite slave is free, the Canaanite slave becomes a Jew. This is the process of slavery in the ancient Jewish community, as described in the Talmud, and probably reflected here in the Bible. When a person becomes a slave, a Canaanite becomes a slave, the slave becomes subject to the law. Okay? A woman becomes totally subject to the law. A man becomes subject to all the laws a woman is subject to. That is to say, all the negative commandments and none of the positive commandments. Okay? So that means that the slave is required to observe the Sabbath. Because it says you shall not do any form of labor on the Sabbath. The slave is not required to shake a lulav, because that's a positive commandment. Okay? Nor is the slave required to go to observe the mitzvah of sukkah. Okay? But the slave is not allowed to commit adultery, because that's a negative commandment. Otin af. Okay? So you have that's the nature of the slave. Question is, if the person is, a woman is a slave, and a free man wants to marry her, so there is some sort of a deal that's made here, but it can't be kiddushin, because kiddushin can only be made between two full Jews. A Jew cannot marry a non-Jew, and the slave is a half-Jew. That's the interesting thing here. The slave is a half a Jew.
You
can't, yes, but you can't marry half a Jew. You have to marry a whole Jew. That's the trick that's involved here. So the ish ki ishkant et isha. So this woman is already designated, as it were, as if she had kiddushin, but she's still a slave, so she really isn't, not really kiddushin. And some other guy comes along and sleeps with her. That's the issue. Another guy, not the first guy, a second guy. Let's turn the tables around. Let's go back to where we were.
It's like the Jewish woman who was at her father's house after Kedushin.
All right. Oh, here you go.
Not permitted, but
right. And another guy comes, a suitor from the past, shows up, goes to bed with her. Sleeps with the lady. Okay, what happens?
We know what's supposed to happen to them.
So what happens to them? What's the nice...
Excommunicated.
Excommunicated? More than that.
They killed.
They're killed. That's a serious form of excommunication. Okay. It's a capital crime. Adultery in Jewish law is a capital crime. You kill them both. You kill them both. Okay? Oh yeah, definitely. Correct. Oh yeah, if it were a rape, would be different. Then he could.
I mean, for by full rape, right?
Yeah.
But we, okay.
Right. These are willing parties. Okay. So here we've got a slightly different case, and we're not sure exactly how to handle. Is this a capital crime? Because she's half a Jew, or is it not a capital crime because she's half a Jew? Okay. So that's what's behind this. So the chofda lo nifteta, she has not yet been given her freedom. So she's only half a Jew, not a whole Jew. O chofsha lo nitanba, her freedom has not been given to her. Bikoret tihia, there shall be an investigation, because you have to know whether in fact her freedom has been given her or has not been given her. If it has been given to her, then she's a Jew like any other Jew, and this is a case of adultery, and it's a capital crime. Right? Bikoret tihia, lo yumtu ki lo chupasha. there shall be no death penalty for them, iloku pasha, if she has not been freed. Right? If she's only half a Jew, then this is not a case of adultery. And in that case, they have to bring he has to bring a trespass offering to the door of the tent of meeting, a ram of a guilt offering. The hiper lava kohen, the ela Hashem, and the kohen has to make atonement for him with this offering for his sin, which he has sinned, and nislach lo mechatato shachata, and he can be forgiven for this sin. Okay? So, in a way, this is a case of sleeping with a woman and not sleeping with a married woman. Sleeping with a woman may be a sin, and therefore you have to repent for it, but you don't die for it. That's the difference. That's the difference, okay? So, that's the background. No questions yet, because that's just background. That's in order for you to be able to understand this. Now, there, this was a woman that was v'hi shifcha necharefet le'ish. She is a shifcha, a female slave, necharefet, designated. Now, the question is, if you borrow a term like that, which is a term that's used by the Torah to clearly indicate something like Kiddushin, except that when the Torah uses it, it uses it in the context of a half a Jew and not a whole Jew, of a female slave. Right? Is that indicative of enough of marriage? Or do we say that because when it was used for a slave and not a full person, that it's not indicative of marriage? He's sort of playing around with her. Now, she knows Torah, he knows Torah, and he's playing around as if she's a shifcha. You know, maybe he's saying to her, look, you know, for this you don't get the death penalty. Okay. All right. Is that what you meant by French? Okay. So that's the question here. So Ibayalaho. Question was asked of them. Harufati mahu. If you use that phrase, harufati, is it kiddushin or is it not kiddushin? And in fact, Tashma, the Tanya. We have a brayta here in response to the question. If the Amoraim ask any bayalaho, and somebody around here knows a brayta, then that's very, very helpful, because a brayta, remember, has a lot of force to it. A brayta, if you can cite a brayta, and the brayta will answer the question is answered. Unless somebody else will prove that the brayta was originally said in some other context and doesn't apply in this context. But generally speaking, citation of a brayta is a very good argument. The Tanya, Ha'omer Harufati Mekudeshet. Here it says specifically, he who says Harufati, she is betrothed. Shekein B'Yehuda Korin La'Arusa Harufa. Interesting, right? As it says, for in the land of Judea, they call a betrothed woman a Harufa. So that, remember, in the land of Israel, there is the southern portion of the land of Israel, which is called Yehuda. Till this day, it's called Yehuda. The area around Jerusalem and south to Beersheba, roughly, is called Yehuda. The area north of Jerusalem is Israel, all right? Or it's referred to by one of the other tribes. Binyamin is immediately to the north of Jerusalem. Ephraim is in that same area. So it says here in the Baraita that if you say Harufati, then the woman is Mekudeshet. Not only that, that's the way they say it in Yehuda. So then the Gemara comes and says, Yehuda Havya Ruba di Alma. Who says Judea is most of the world? And what kind of proof is this? Just because they say it in Judea, does that make it right? All right, Ruba di Alma, that's everybody? because they say it in Judea, maybe it's a weirdo. You know, they're weird in Judea. They say these things, but doesn't go for everybody else. Just because they say it, that's the law. What kind of an argument is that? So it's nice of an interview with that. Have you remembered the element? Right. Then the Gemara answers by rewriting, as it were, the Baraita, and saying, Achikamar, this is, either this means this is what the Baraita means, or this is what the Baraita is supposed to say. It could be that there were varying traditions on what the Baraita actually said. Or this is interpretive. This is an explanation of the Baraita. Ha'omer charufati mekudeshet. If a person says charufati, she's mekudeshet. Shenemar, because it says v'hi shivcha mecharefet le'ish. This is a quote now that I just read to you from the book of Leviticus. V'od b'Yehuda korin la'arusa charufa. And moreover, in Judea they call an arusa charufa. Okay? So this just restructures the Brit. It's the same information, but it just restructures it in such a way that it says, first of all, the fact, then it gives you a biblical source, and then it says, moreover, by the way, you should know that in Yehuda they call it a Musa Harufa. But the Marav then goes on and says, Yehuda, the old Likra. You mean to say, you mean to bring, you're rewriting this writer, you're explaining the writer, Judea is further proof of a verse. If you have a verse, why are you telling me what they do in Judah? That's no proof. It's in a way demeaning to the verse. A verse is a verse. All right, so maybe you proved it from a verse. So what do I need to know about you, about your Hudasla? Right? It's demeaning to do that. So the Gemara doesn't like this. So then it tries again. Elahachi kamash. But no, this is the way to say it. Ha'omer charufa b'Yehuda mekudeshet. Here changes the point. Ha'omer charufa b'Yehuda. The person who says charufati at in Yehuda is mekudeshet. So only in Yehuda. Only in Yehuda. Why? Shekein b'Yehuda korin la'arusa charufa. Because in Yehuda they call an arusa charufa. So suddenly what started out as a general acceptance of this formulation of charufa is no longer a general acceptance. The final reformulation of the Baraita is that only in Yehuda is this good, and the logic is important here because it's obvious. Where in fact charufa is used as terminology for mikudeshet of a woman who is an arusa, then it's clear. Clarity is our need here. We want to have clear statements. We want to know from the words that are said, and you'll see in a moment, maybe even from the circumstances that are surrounding this, that it is very clear that this gift is a gift for the purpose of creating a marriage and not to give a gift. Okay? So I think that's the bottom line here. We again see what's important is the issue of clarity. And the Charufa in general may or may not be clear. In Yehuda it was clear, and so we finally decide that in Yehuda you can use language like that. And obviously things change depending upon place and circumstance. And there is a recognition of that in terms of Yehuda. Okay? Yes.
If the Bible says that Charufa is the half a Jew of a Jew in quarters, that means that in Judah they accepted the Jew in quarters as a Jew?
Maybe yes, maybe no. Because eventually what it means is that in Yehuda they simply were willing to borrow the terminology and to work that terminology into their slang. And it doesn't necessarily mean that we have to learn from that half a Jew is a whole Jew in Yehuda.
It would be accepted as
Mekudeshet,
that means that the
rabbinical
authority there accepted it as a
Kiddushot. Not necessarily.
What are they saying?
It's just language. It's just slang. It's the slang in your. And you may learn that, you may not learn that. I don't know that you have to learn that from it. Okay.
It was so frequent that it got into the language.
Yeah.
These cases would so frequently happen.
Could be. Could be.
Well, it would have to be the case, because otherwise it's pretty demeaning. I mean, if everybody who used it knew the original connotation.
Right. It's quite demeaning, because I would think that it would be a demeaning thing to use. You wouldn't want to use language like that. That's not nice to use language toward a slave, unless it's considered to be somehow affectionate. And did people ever use, can I think of any phrase like that?
We have the opposite, in Babylonia, they adopted the term seduction for Aristotle, to use them interchangeably.
Right, right, right.
There's not been any explanation of why they did
it. Correct. That's what I think. Yes.
In the case of the 40-Jewish man having sexual relations with his non-freed slave, where does the question of whether the man is married or not married come in?
Where is the question, and what's her status? Has she been designated for a man yet or not?
Irrespective of
it that. It makes a difference. It's
whether
a difference.
He's married or whether he's not
married. He's married or not married doesn't make any difference. In those times, it made no difference. Because he is living in a polygamous world, where polygamy is permitted, and so therefore, from the man's perspective, polygamy is the same as if you have no wife at all, actually. If you have one wife, two wives, 10 wives, no wives, all the same. Because you can have as many wives in theory as possible. And therefore you could, in theory, sleep with as many unmarried women. You know, you shouldn't do it, you'd have to bring a korban. You're not supposed to do that, but if you do it, you do it. Okay? I'm not suggesting anything. Okay. All right. We go on. The Maya Stephen. Now here, the Gemara is going to now raise a more general question. We had the cases of miuchedetli, miuedetli, all of those things. Now, the Gemara raises a more general question. What was the context in which these phrases were used? So far we've been concerned about the specificity of language and knowing that an accurate phrase was used so that it was clear, clarity was important. Now we're going to change the question. We start out with these unclear phrases, many of which we didn't resolve, and now we go to a more general question, the Mayaskinen. What is the context of this? What's the context? And listen to the way that Gemara fleshes it out. Ilema b'she'in medaberi ma'al iske gita v'kidushah. I don't know whether this language is accurate, really, because I'll translate it first, and then I'll tell you what I don't like about it. If we say that the context is this, she'en medaberma, that he and she are not involved in a conversation where they are talking about matters of marriage and divorce. I don't know why there's divorce mentioned there. Many of the commentators raise the question of whether that really should say divorce, but it may, there may be a reason why it should say divorce. It may be just the way it was. And there's, later on, the language does involve saying divorce. Right, so if we mean that this formulation is used in a context where they are not already talking about marriage, Nina yad'a mai kamala. How would she know what he is saying to her? I said, we want to know what the context is. So there are two possibilities. Do we mean that he uses this uncertain phrase, the phrase miuchedetli, which we're not sure about whether he can make kiddushin with that? Do we mean that he says that in a context where they're not talking about marriage in the first place? And the Gemara says, if that's the case, how would she know that he was talking about marriage? It's so amorphous, a phrase like this, yuchedetli, you're special to me. Why would we even think that there was a marriage? Just because a guy says to a woman, you're special to me. That would be a tough thing to say. If every time you said it, you get married. Okay. I'm sorry. So that's dangerous. So it couldn't possibly be that the question is asked in that context, with that context in mind. The elabi midaberi ma alis ke gita vekidusha. But rather, it must be asked when in fact they're talking about marriage. So the context must be one where they're conversing about marriage already. Then look what it says. Afalgav dela malanami. Well, in that case, even if he didn't say that specific language, she could still be married.
Oh,
that's throwing me a fast one. I didn't assume that. I assumed that all of this prior discussion was in order to make sure that you have to say something. When you say it, you have to say it clearly. Turns out, that's not quite that way. At least as far as the discussion with Gemara is going now, it could be that context could provide everything. And a lot depends upon the circumstances. And the circumstances could be so clear that even without saying anything, just because you said, oh, let's get married. Oh, I love you. You give her a ring. Takes it. You know what? You're married. Okay. And then it gives a baraita, ditnan. It's a Mishnah. You have a Mishnah now to support this. Hayam medaber imisha aliske gita v'kidushah. If a man was speaking with a woman about matters of marriage or divorce, and he gave her either the divorce or the marriage. That is to say, the kiddushin. So it interests us. Excuse me, here is the kiddushin. The loke rash. And he didn't explain specifically what was going on. Namely, he didn't say, hareyat mekodeshet li with this. Loke rash. Rabbi Yossi omer dayo. Rabbi Yossi says it's enough. Context is crucial. And context is enough to make it a marriage. Rabbi Yehuda omer tarich lefaresh. Rabbi Yehuda says, no, you have to say it specifically. So these are the 2 points in here. These are the 2 points in here. Hold on just a minute. The Amar Huna Amar Shmuel, and Rav Huna said in the name of Shmuel, Halacha Rabbi Yossi. He says that the law goes according to Rabbi Yossi. Rabbi Yossi says that the context is what counts. Even if he is lomafarish, if he doesn't say anything explicit, it's enough if the context makes it clear. Okay? Amre liolam de mibidaberi ma aliske gita vikidusheha. Alright? Then it goes on and it says, they say that always, really the question involves the case in which he was speaking with her about matters of marriage or divorce. The idea hivlavishati, if he gave her this thing that they had been talking about it, and it was clear that what was going on, the Iyahiv Ladashatik, and he gives her money and doesn't say a word, Hachinami, it's okay. Okay? It's a real valid kiddushin. Hachabamayaskinan. Here, what kind of case are we dealing with? The Ahivla Vyamala Bahanilishne, in which he gave her the money after talking marriage and he spoke to her using one of these vague expressions. Atmiyuchedetli, so on. The Hachikamabayali, And the question now is that we have to ask ourselves is Hani Lishni Likidushe Kamala or Dilma Limalacha Kamala? When he uses a vague expression, sometimes you can use a vague expression which takes you into another realm. If you didn't say anything at all and you gave her the kesef, it could have been clear that this was kiddushin. If you then raise an expression which she doesn't know whether what you are saying now is changing the subject or continuing the subject, then in fact you've made it more difficult and not less difficult. And that's the question, in fact, that the Gemara meant to ask originally and why it was unsure about these phrases. Because these were phrases that could all have been interpreted to mean not marriage, but milacha, namely, will you wash my clothes for me? Right? Will you do my laundry on Mondays and Thursdays? It's very nice. It's, you know, maybe she'll do your laundry on Mondays and Thursdays. But does that mean she? Does that mean to say that she's also your wife? You know, that she gets to go 50-50 from here on.
So these phrases complicate.
They complicate.
Nothing
at all. It is easy. So we learn from this the rather startling conclusion to begin with. That in fact you don't have to say anything.
This is why men never talk.
Right?
Relationship.
That's a good reason.
You may be very sensitive to the fact. You may be absolutely right. So much of this. I mean, just think about it a little bit in terms of the psychology of our own experience, even though it goes against, what can I say, the political correctness of what we're supposed to say. The reality is, first of all, the language, when you use language. And then a man has to say it and the woman can't say it. I mean, isn't this also just natural to assume that? I mean, how many women propose to men?
Supposedly a lot.
Really? Well, then it's a new day. I don't know that.
No.
Really? How many women engineer men to propose to them? That's another story. Yes. I'm not, that could be most cases. I mean, I'm not saying that. But I have the feeling that generally we expect the men to say, will you marry? She's trying to move it along today if she wants it. But I think we expect it. And in a way, it's somehow sexually related. There's a male role and a female role here, which seems natural, I must say. And, you know, that's reflected partly here in the law of the male initiation, or at least the structure of it. And then the other side of it is the silence. The silent male. You know, allowance is made for it. Allowance is made for the guy who just can't talk. And maybe there's room for that too, because in fact there are men like that, and maybe there are even a lot of men like that, and that could still be a perfectly valid condition, because context can mean as much as words, and there is validity given to that. Now, when you asked me before, did there have to be witnesses? I said I didn't think so, because having read all of this, my sense is that this wouldn't make sense. It sort of is really interesting because there aren't witnesses. Again, I don't know for sure whether there are witnesses or not. Eventually, of course, the law becomes structured in a different way. As you know, a wedding ceremony itself is witnessed. There are phrases. There's a phrase that has to be said during the kiddushin. There are two witnesses that have to be there. So that in the long run of things, what we do is that in fact we do structure the things. the naked witness. Even more than that, at a later stage of the game, the law is even that there has to be a minion. Right? Now, there's no mention of that in the early stage of the law, and that is just because as marriage develops itself in terms of the life of the community, there is the need to have it very public. And the minion is the statement of the public nature of what could be conceived of as a private ceremony. So I think we are seeing it here in this text at an early stage of its formulation, when the issues are being ferreted out. And at this stage of the game, it seems to me it's rather private, at least on the surface it appears to be. There was a thrust to have a clear statement, but you see that there is also a willingness here to accept for the possibility of no statement at all, even if that is not the preferable way or the common way to do it. It is still possible for that to happen and for it to be a kosher transaction.
I'm just wondering, the five parts where there was the vagueness about whether or not what it said and what it actually means, they're saying that they're only going to be kiddushim. That's not actually marriage. Mm-hmm. The word the part of the divorce meaning there, it's put in there that they would require a divorce. Then. Mm-hmm.
That's correct. Correct, because after the kiddushin, if they were going to call it off at that point, you wouldn't need a divorce.
And that's why the words are there.
Probably. That's a good logical reason why the words are there. Another possibility is that they're there by mistake. That's what I sort of want to feel. I like to have my texts read the way I want them to read. And it would read better if it weren't there.
If it was put in two or three times.
Correct. That's a big problem to me.
No, you can use it all for the whole
day. The problem is, correct.
I don't know if it's in the end.
The problem is that the laws of Gittin are somewhat different than the laws of Kiddushin. Just the way it's structured is different. But you can be sure that the rabbis agree with you. I mean, they actually agree with what you're saying. And they say that, well, even though the laws are different, there's a way to look at it where the laws wouldn't be different. In this case, you know, there's a similarity between it. Because they do want the text to always make sense. I'm still looking for a scribal error to better for it.
This is so different from the idea of Jewish marriage that I'm familiar with. Actually, fairly recent time with my certainly my grandparents' generation, they never would have had this opportunity to be talking to the woman at all on any subject ever. I know my father said they met right before the wedding. It was all arranged.
Well, she does them.
What?
So there are two possibilities here. The first possibility here is that that's exactly what's going on, and the chaperone is sitting with them while all of this is happening. So you would say, I could say there are 10 witnesses here. 10 witnesses, or 2 witnesses, whatever you want. And you'll say, well, where is it written? I said, well, it's not written. So you'll say, well, how do you know? So I say to you, well, how couldn't it be? So what I'm trying to say is, one way of reading this is that what your father's generation and their parents' generation knew, in fact, was the same as here. The other way of reading this is that this is radically different, and in fact, what they knew is not what was known in the Talmud. And in fact, there was a different reality in the time of the Talmud. The Talmud did allow for closer relations between the sexes than, in fact, we are willing to admit, and that there were these conversations. And if there had been chaperones, we probably would have known about it. And I can't tell you which of those is true.
Sounds like the latter.
Could be, couldn't it?
And as you say, it even takes into account for the guy who goes here.
It sounds like it's something done between the man and the woman.
Another possibility
to
another possibility which we should keep in mind is that what we are reading here is a compilation of legal discussions and not necessarily of real life activities. So that however these things happen in real life, maybe we just don't know how they happen. We only know how the rabbis talked about them when they sat around discussing the issues. So that they were not interested really in telling stories in this context as much as deriving legal issues. So that in a way we just don't, I don't know how much we can learn about daily life from what we're reading, except that in some way even the theoretical discussions reflect things that must have been happening. But we don't know exactly what was happening. We don't know whether they were there alone, whether they were there with the family. That we just have no information on. Okay, so I think that's a compromise position between the two.
I think that the right to avoid you, like,
darling, do my laundry, and
study
the darling. But that's absolutely. That's clear. They want to avoid those situations. Or even those situations that are not quite so clear, like, darling, I have dirty laundry.
The generations before us, like this gentleman said, our grandparents were more so arranged marriages than nowadays.
Than nowadays, and maybe even the time of the Talmud.
No, but the Rambam said that before the Torah, they used to walk the market and they talk. So there wasn't an arranged marriage. They met on a full Torah.
Well, what they did in the time of the Talmud, 800 years before the Rambam, also a question. It's a well, correct. No, that's also a good point. I mean, keep in mind the biblical stories that we read. Those are real life stories. I mean, I think that you really have a sense from those stories about what happened. And the Bible's full of all kinds of things that we would never be comfortable with.
Young people at the time, for
sure.
I think last year was study of mourning, and so I did tell a story about a guy who picked up his sister-in-law after the funeral.
Remember that? And he decided to marry him?
Yeah,
that's correct. They got married. Exactly. Let me read to you now the Shulchan Aruch. This is Eben HaEzer, which is the Laws of Marriage, Siman Kaf Zayin, chapter 27, the law number 3, Seif Gimel. Amar La, if he says to her, Hare at miyuedet li, those were the questionable terms, yuchedet li, you are my singular one, Ezrati, my help me, Negzati, Salati, my rib, Segurati, my closed one, Tachtai, the one who is in my place, Atsurati, Tifusati, Hare Zep Zomekudeshet Besasek. This is dealt with by the Shulchan Aruch, same way as we had an issue last week, that this is marriage Besasek. She's not married and she is married at the same time. So that in at that point what we have to do in order to clear it up is to give her a gift. Okay, because only then will she be able to be clearly married. She's gotta do it again. Gotta do it again. Alright? The Huadin, now this is now I read to you the Shulchan Aruch of Rabbi Yosef Karo. This is about 1560. Now I'm going to read to you the comments of Rabbi Moshe Isserles, which add the Ashkenazi dimension to the Sephardi customs. He says, "Huadin imamar la hareat harufati," and this is true also if he says to her, "You are my harufa." That was his last sentence. Isha necheresit, the woman designated. Aval amar la hareat nesuati. If he says to her, "You are my married one," yesh omrim she'en al klum. There are those who say, excuse me, that's of no value at all. he goes on. Now this is the Shulchan Aruch again. Who she yehiye medaber ima tachila al iskei kiddushin. And now we are talking in all of these doubtful cases where they were conversing about matters of marriage. About im eino medaber ima tachila al iskei kiddushin. But if they are not talking about matters of marriage, ein choshishim lemilot elu. We pay no attention to these words. Okay? So these words, the possibility of safsei kiddushim, is only where there was a context, more or less, of marriage. But those words, remember, the problem with them was that you could create problems with those words. Right? Mm-hmm. Had they been just uncertain, would be one thing. But the Gemara's problem is that they can create problems. Therefore, we have a case of chashash, of doubtful kiddushin. Now goes on now, Rabbi Moshe Itzavis. Misha amar li'isha. Excuse me? Misha amar li'isha. A man who says to a woman, shenotein la bishvil ahava v'chiba, that he is giving her these things because he loves her. Choshashin l'kiddushin. We're concerned that this may be kiddushin. V'chi shema amar shenotein la shiyihye ahava v'chiba b'nehem. But maybe he just means, on the one hand, it could be that he's trying to marry her with this. On the other hand, it could be that he's just trying to say that he loves her. Right? He loves her, and that's why he's giving her these things. Havei ke'elu amarla, this is like the situation of, had he said to her, mi'u'edetli or mi'u'chedetli. Now he gets back to the original ones. He says it's like that. Yesh omri, and there are those who say, Af al gav di lishonot elu lo mahani in lo diberi mami iskei kiddushin, that these formulations are ineffective unless they were talking about matters of marriage. Mikol makom im hi omeret shekibla l'shem kiddushin, if she says in response that she accepts the gift for the sake of marriage, right? Even if these are doubtful. But she, in her response, makes it clear that she understands that this was marriage. He's not sure. She is sure. Then it's again another case of safek kiddushin. Maybe they're married, maybe they're not married. V'afilo natan la bishtika. Even if he gives her now something bishtika, in complete silence. V'lo diber klum. And he says nothing. V'hu v'hi omrim, and they both say, he and she say, shekivnu l'shem kiddushin, that they both understood that what was happening was for the sake of marriage. Havei kiddushin, they're married. So it matters what they understand the intention to be. Remember, in marriage, you need two willing parties. They have to both agree. And if after it's all over they do both agree, nothing was said, but there is an act of kiddushin by which something is given from the man to the woman, and they both understand that that was for the sake of kiddushin, they're married. And that's the bottom line. That's the law. Okay?
They don't have to say anything.
They don't have to say anything. It's not where I expected we would come out. And that is nonetheless, what the law.
That's a beautiful recital of all so many conversations that we know still from today.
That's amazing.
I've just been reminded I know Shakespeare tremendously well.
Great idea to examine some of these things in Shakespeare, because it's somewhat contemporaneous, really. You're dealing with 16th century.
It's people who observe how people behave.
Exactly. And in case anybody says to you also that maybe in the Talmud people knew about love, but in the Middle Ages in Poland they never thought of it. This is written in Krakow, 1560. I mean, this is life. Young men and women are falling in love. And they're dealing with that reality. And they're reflecting the language and the implications of the way in fact people are when they're young and they're full of flighty thoughts.
In the case of the doubtful cases, why couldn't you go to a real commission instead of going to get and then another commission?
Because if there's already a marriage, you can't have a marriage on top of a marriage.
You put to the same person?
Yep. Somebody, I had a problem like that recently. Somebody said to me, they said, we want to get married in a certain state because we've got college tuitions and it's cheaper if we get married, but we don't want to get married. I said like this. We'll get married in that state according to the law of the state, and then after graduation, we'll come back and you'll marry us. Okay, you'll marry us according to Jewish law. Okay? So, what do I say? First, it's not a good idea. Right, I'm the classic party pooper, you know. They knew enough, they were coming to see the rabbi, the smart people, they knew what the rabbi was like. So I had to say it. So I said it anyway. And then in fact, it's interesting, the law of the state of New York, it's also illegal. Unless you do the following. The law of the state of New York, if they got married in Nevada, let's say, I can't then officiate at some later time in New York, because I'm an agent of the state of New York. I'm not allowed to do that. Because that's two marriages. One person's getting married twice. Unless, in New York State, what happens is, you can go to the city clerk's office and get a marriage license. On the marriage license, you tell them that you are already civilly married in Nevada, and then they allow you a second marriage for the purposes of religion.
Yeah.
They allow you that.
For
the purposes of religion. But it's also a valid marriage in the state of New York. See, they want to have a record. What they're trying to fight against is that they don't want clergy who officiated all kinds of marriages which are illegal. And that's only one possibility.
So they revalidate.
There are all kinds of things that you could be doing. The state wants to oversee everything that happens. So they don't want the clergy to be operating independently of the laws of the state. So we have to do things, and you have to get a separate marriage license. Even though you've been married once before, you have to get another marriage license in order to get married religiously in the state of New York.
That was the situation of the age of consent is different in other states.
That's also true. That could be an issue. That could be an issue. Could be an issue.
So with new vows, what a lot of things are doing nowadays from the Jewish aspect, is it allowed, not allowed?
It has no legal validity either in the state or in Judaism. If it's a way of having a good time, you can do anything.
Well,
rabbis also know how to have a good time. Once in a while. Ladies and gentlemen, to be continued.
Thank you.